to the Ladies of Liverpool podcast.
Everything Liverpool.
Everything for ladies.
Ladies of Liverpool.
With Leanne Campbell.
Sponsored by Taskers, with a fresh new look, designed with you in mind. Find Taskers on Instagram. Search Taskers online. Here we are again, your weekly podcast, Ladies of Liverpool. We're in our fifth year, I think, now. Every week, a different episode, a different guest, a different story to hear from. And I think a different message. Like this week, we're talking about something a little bit more serious. I think each and every one of us can honestly say we know someone, maybe not directly, a friend of a friend, hopefully not someone in your family, but we all know someone who's been affected by suicide. Times are changing, thankfully. We're hoping support is getting a little bit better for the families that are left behind. It's a tough one to understand. It really is, and people have really strong opinions on it. So today's episode, we've got someone who's lived and breathed it, who's made change right across the country and wakes up every day with a very clear mission. And you're about to find out what it is. Jessica, thank you so much for coming into our studios today. Someone sent me a message saying, you need to speak to Jess because she's done amazing things. And quite often on our podcast, we have people who've dealt with something really crappy, something really awful that you can't imagine yourself bouncing back from. But when you hear from someone who has, it inspires the whole of the nation. And people are listening not only in the UK, but abroad to this podcast. Our Scousers who've left Liverpool, who want a touch of home. And you are going to inspire them today. Jessica, what are you here to talk about?
Oh, thank you. That was a really lovely intro, by the way.
Oh, thank
I love
you.
That. I love that. So I'm here to talk about the Martin Gallier Project, which is a suicide prevention, intervention and postvention charity based here in the Northwest, but expanding really, really quickly. A little bit too fast, faster than my little feet can go, but that's absolutely fine. And the whole concept, the whole idea of the Martin Gallier Project is to provide crisis support for people that are considering suicide at the time that they need it, straight away within their communities on the high street, demedicalized, non-clinical support with no waiting lists, no barriers to access, no criteria. And yeah, we started out in New Ferry on the Wirral. From very humble beginnings, we had 64 pence in the bank account on the day that we started. And everyone said, this is ridiculous. This is not going to work. This is crazy, Jess. And I said,
honestly, this is how all the great things begin.
Oh, yeah.
When people, the public, friends, family are a bit like, what are you doing? This is crazy. And then they work and then everyone's like, what if you hadn't have tried? What if you hadn't have done this? So this started because something happened to you. Very personal. You lost your dad, didn't you, Martin? And that's, of course, who the charity is named after. How old were you when you lost your dad?
So I was 26. I had just had Leo. So Leo was 12 weeks old. So I was the happiest woman on the planet. I was like euphoric. I just felt like the most lucky girl in the world, you know?
The candy floss months, I call it. I felt like I was in candy floss land.
Oh, yeah, it's just gorgeous, isn't it?
And then you hear awful stories of women who aren't in that place where, you know, the hormones aren't doing the right things for them and they're feeling the opposite. But if anyone knows what that feeling like, those first few weeks, first few months with your baby, they are special times.
They are. And I felt so lucky and so privileged that I always thought that I would be one of those mums that really struggled after giving birth.
Yeah.
Struggled with my mental health in the past. And I always thought that that would be the case, but it wasn't. And it was the most beautiful time. And I was ecstatic, the happiest woman in the world, until I wasn't, until I got that phone call. And I'm really open about it. I'm really comfortable talking about it because I think you have to talk about this stuff because it helps other people, right? I got that phone call when Leo was 12 weeks old to say that my dad had taken his own life. And I just went from the top of the world, the happiest woman in the world, to the depths of despair in the space of one phone call.
So were you expecting it? Were the signs at the time or signs when you look back? Because I've heard different stories from siblings of people who've taken their own life or wives of people who've taken their own life, never from the child. Yeah. So it would be interesting to see, because you were an adult, you had a baby of your own. Did you see the signs? Were you concerned about your dad before you got this phone call?
And it's a bit of an anomaly, really. Can't say that word. Anomaly. that a lot of people say, oh, there were no signs, we didn't see it coming. And in all honesty, I saw it coming a mile off. Yeah. We'd seen it for a really long time. So my dad was 55 at that point. I was 26. And I remember when I was about kind of 13, 14, my dad telling me that when his life became too much, he would end his life. And that is the way that his life would end.
Yeah.
And that just became kind of a normal part of our lives. And we didn't really know what to do with that information. Because
so that thought was already there, going back to your teens.
Yeah.
And he was verbalising it. He was vocal about it.
Yeah.
And what was the reaction of your mum?
Well, my mum and dad were separated. They separated when I was a little girl. My dad was remarried. I, as the eldest child, became my dad's kind of closest person. Mm-hmm. My dad was a wonderful man, very eccentric, really funny, life and soul of the party, but he was complicated. He wasn't great at holding down relationships and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I became his person. And, you know, as a teenager hearing, you know, when my life becomes too much, I'll end my own life. I suppose I didn't take it seriously. And I didn't know what to do with that because nobody taught me at school mm-hmm. what to do with a disclosure like that, with information like that.
Yeah.
So we kind of always just like battered it off, I guess, and never really thought anything of it. It just became part of life. Yes. I didn't know that that wasn't normal and that people didn't like just talk about that. And then, you know, obviously it happened when I was 26 and I could see it coming an absolute mile off. His life had really gone downhill. Things were really not good for him. We were kind of really fighting for, he was out of area, so I feel like I can be a bit more open about it, but fighting for the help that he needed, and the help just didn't come.
Yeah.
And the help that did come was clinical and medical, and not what a man in his 50s would kind of opt into or stick with.
Mm-hmm.
So any help that did kind of come out of that just wasn't right for him. And what he needed was somebody to sit alongside him in that time, somebody that wasn't us, to sit alongside him in that time and say, what's going on, Martin? Tell me all the reasons why you want to die. Let's work through this together.
Yes, yeah.
And that just wasn't there for him, unfortunately. So, yeah, we did see it come in a mile off.
So break that down for me then, Jess. So someone you love, a parent, a friend, a partner, they're showing signs that they're having suicidal thoughts, or they're verbalising it, or however it comes across in many different ways for many different people. If you had concerns, what happens there? Who do you even contact? And then what comes back? You're saying it's like medical situation. Yeah. Was it the GP? Is there a helpline? Was there something in place that you think, you know, could be a whole lot better?
Yeah. Well, my dad kind of got stuck in this revolving cycle of going to A&E when he didn't feel good.
Yeah.
Spending a bit of time in A&E, or even being admitted, being kind of released back out, and then nothing had really changed, because what he was being met with was medical intervention.
Yeah.
And what he needed was non-clinical support.
Okay.
To really work through what had gone on for him. And A&E is great. The NHS is fantastic.
Yeah.
I partnered with the NHS. I'm not here to say anything negative about them. I never would. However, I think what we need to recognise is that it's not the answer to all of our problems.
No.
And to go to an A&E department, a medical facility,
yeah.
You are going to be met with a medical response.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be what's needed for somebody that's suffering with acute mental illness. But if somebody's suffering with life stuff, stuff that can happen to any of us, relationship breakdown, financial problems,
mm-hmm.
debt, struggling to see your children, exam pressure, that list is endless. That need is not going to be met in A&E.
Exactly.
And that's where the gap is. Mm-hmm. And that's the gap we decided to fill.
Okay. So let's go back to that day. You have the phone call
mm-hmm.
with your dad,
yeah.
about your dad. And who was it who called you?
It was my sister. Yeah, my youngest sister, Libby, she phoned me. I was in a restaurant on Castle Street and I had Leo in the pram and my knees just kind of went from underneath me.
Mm-hmm.
They just went. My legs went to jelly. And without kind of getting too graphic with the situation, he hadn't physically died.
Yeah.
But there was no brain activity left. So we did have a bit of time to go and spend with him and kind of wait until that moment. So I was in, you know, complete and utter shock, and I didn't know what to do. And I phoned my mum and I said, Mum, I don't know what to do. And my dad was down in kind of Cheltenham, Gloucester way. And I looked up and I saw, you know, the old Cheltenham, Gloucester bank building on Castle Street.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw that and I said, Mum, I know what to do. It's all right. I'm getting on a train. I'm going.
Yeah.
I didn't drive at the time. And if I had been able to drive at the time, I probably shouldn't have anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. So I got on a train with him in a little car seat, and just, I'm so glad that I made it in time to go and like say my goodbyes.
So then you're dealing with your grief and you're going through the months, the years that have built up to this. Yeah. And I always say when you lose anyone, and you know, we've all dealt with grief in different ways and we've lost different people. And I always say the only thing I can ever cling on to when I lose someone I love is the no regrets. If I can sit there and say, I've got no regrets, that helps me out in a situation like this, where you've done everything you can, but there are regrets because you think if things would have been in place, if this would have been different, if that would have been different, that's got to be really tough on your mental health. Yeah. How do you deal with that, Jess?
I mean, that's the worst part, I think, of suicide grief is that guilt and those questions. And what if I'd done this? And what if I'd gone? Yeah. And for the first time in my dad's life, I hadn't raced to him when he needed help because I'd just had this baby.
Yeah.
And I'd raced to him my whole life since I was a young girl. I'd been that one that went, you know, and this time I'd kind of said, no, Dad, like, I've just had this baby. I need you to stand on your own 2 feet. And, you know, and yeah, I'll regret that for the rest of my life. However, I didn't know what I didn't know. And I suppose that's my message to anybody that's bereaved by suicide. Those questions, those things that keep you awake at night. What if I'd done this? What if I'd said that? What if I'd known this? What if I'd been educated about it? Then what if I'd been trained? You didn't know what you didn't know.
This must be such a huge part of dealing with the grieving process for anyone who's lost someone through suicide.
Yeah, it's huge.
Because those questions, they're never ending, are they? But at the end of the day, you can't fix somebody else. You can't stop something happening if that's what somebody is planning on doing. And it sounds like your dad had verbalised it. He'd, you know, he'd thought about it and he'd openly discussed it. You can't ask his daughter without trapping someone in a room and, you know, taking everything from them, leaving them naked in a room with absolutely nothing. You cannot stop them doing it.
Well, I don't, I might argue with you on that slightly.
Go on.
Because if I'd known then what I know now,
yeah,
I wholeheartedly believe my dad would still be alive. But you don't get taught this stuff in school. And I suppose that's really part of this movement and this mission is to, you know, say to people, go and get yourself educated. We're going to schools from year seven. That's becoming mandatory from September 2026.
Yeah.
Just been passed. And I think that suicide prevention is everybody's business and everybody can learn. It doesn't have to be a huge, you don't have to go to university for years and years and years. You can go and learn in the space of a couple of hours some really simple things that you can do to help keep the people you love safe from suicide.
This is what's so important then. This is why you're here today. So educate us.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us what we should be looking for, what we can do. Because I just imagine if you've got someone dealing with suicidal thoughts, that powerless feeling must be, you know, off the scale. You love someone and you want the best for them. Tell us, well, what should we be looking for? What should we be doing?
So I think it's important to recognise that that you should never try and carry it on your own, okay? So there's so much support available and knowing where to look for that support is really important, but also being able to spot the signs and ask the question with someone you love can keep them safe just for long enough till you get them to that support that they need. So keeping an eye on the people that you love and watching for any changes in behaviour, anything drastic, anything, and both ways. So not just if somebody's suddenly really sad. If somebody's been, you know, really down for a long time and suddenly they're really happy, that's important to look out for as well.
Okay.
Any kind of phrases like, I've had enough, I'm done, hopeless, helpless, worthless, anything with less at the end of it is a big sign. You know, people giving away their possessions, people kind of tying up all the loose ends, people saying stuff like, oh, it'll all be done soon, don't worry about it, don't worry, I've got a plan, it'll all be done soon. All these things could be invitations that somebody needs to talk about suicide, and not being afraid to ask the question is my number one tip. Ask that question. It's not a dirty word. Clearly and directly, are you having thoughts of suicide? Are you thinking about ending your own life? If you want to be a little bit more gentle about it, you can say, I've just noticed that you've said X, Y, Z. Sometimes when people say things like that, they're considering suicide. Are you? You know, you can lead into it, but there's no space for ambiguity here. So there's no space for, oh, you're thinking about hurting yourself, or like, are you not thinking of doing something silly, are you? Because all we're doing is telling them that A, we think what they're talking about is silly. And B, we're saying you're not thinking about, so we're already telling them we're not comfortable with the answer. So asking clear and direct questions about suicide, waiting for that answer and then not panicking when we get the answer.
Yeah.
Taking a breath, taking a second to say, thank you so much for trusting me with that. Let's get you the help that you need. Now, if you want to go and get yourself trained in suicide intervention, we can do that for you. It's no problem. We've got funding for people that are supporting a loved one. So if somebody's got a loved one, someone, a family member, a friend, whatever, that's going through this, we can train them up to support that person.
I'm really conscious that there will be listeners now thinking of an individual in their life, mm-hmm. thinking of someone they're concerned of, and everything you say is resonating with them, and they're thinking, okay, so I've identified that person. Mm-hmm. I've asked the question, and that question's been answered with what we didn't want to hear, but they've been honest and they've told us they are thinking, what then?
Yeah, so it depends. So if you feel confident to start an intervention with someone, you've gone and done a bit of training or something like that, do the intervention, slow everything down, do that intervention with them. If you don't, that's your time to hand over, isn't it, to somebody that can do that.
Talk me through an intervention.
Oh gosh, it's very complex in terms of every individual is different.
Mm-hmm.
So every person that you meet that's considering suicide is considering suicide for different reasons. So there's no textbook intervention.
Yeah.
The way that we deliver an intervention at the Martin Gallier Project is research-backed and evidence-based. It's come from a framework that we've borrowed from Canada. It's been going for 40 years, so we know it's super safe.
Yeah.
The way our suicide intervention workers work is that they speak to our person and they hear all the reasons why this person wants to die, which sounds really dark, doesn't it? Really difficult. But out of those reasons for wanting to die, the SIWs are really highly trained and highly skilled to spot and listen for signs of hope, doubt, or uncertainty. Because suicide will never leave space for any of those. So if you spot any of those, there's a chance here. Mm-hmm. There's a chance to keep our person alive. So they'll spot elements of doubt. They'll say, all I want to do is die, but well, what about that but? What was that but?
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish there was another way out. Okay. If we could give you another way out, what would you be interested? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the way our SIWs then work and the service works is that they kind of repeat that back to the person. The person says, no, you're right, I'm not 100% certain. And we never take options away, we give a third option. So the two options on the table for our person that's thinking about suicide, as they see it right now, is life and death. Death's huge, right? It's forever. The life thing with everything that they've got going on, that's a really big commitment too. And we don't take either option away. We give a third option.
Mm-hmm.
And the third option is, let's just stay safe for now.
Yeah.
Let's not make a decision. Let's stay safe for now and work on these things together. And the people say, yeah, okay, let's do that. You're right. I'm not sure. Yeah, you're right. I'm a bit hopeful about the future. Yeah, I've got doubts. Let's try this safety for now thing. Then we use the safety for now to come up with a collaborative safety plan with them. So we don't do it to them or do it for them. We do it together. And they feed in all the stuff that they've got or they can do or other services we can pull in to help them through that time. We spend a bit of time disabling the suicide plan if they've got one, kind of getting rid of the means if they've got the stuff. And we build that together. And at the end of that, we say, with this plan, how long can you stay safe for? And they might say 3 days. They might say 6 months. They might say an hour. And whatever they say, if they say 3 days, we say, okay, let's do it again in 3 days. We'll do it again in 3 days.
So what's clear from this is that the intervention doesn't have to be something you carry yourself. It's not just you trying to keep someone alive who is saying they don't want to be alive. They can come to you. So now you are like this emergency service.
Yeah, it's terrifying. I knew it was going to be big,
mm-hmm.
but it's growing so fast. I didn't know it was going to be so successful. People started coming to us from day four after we opened our front doors. And the idea was really simple. The idea came from my dad's inquest when I sat and went through all the inquest files and highlighted all these gaps in provision. And I noticed that people were dying for really silly reasons, things like waiting list criteria.
Yeah.
And I thought, we can do better than that. I could spend the rest of my life asking for people to do better than that.
Yeah.
Or if you want something done properly, do it yourself. So I thought, I'll have a go. So we built that service around what my dad would have needed and didn't get. So those gaps in provision, that's why we'll never ever have a waiting list. That's why we're open 7 days a week. I don't know how we manage to stay open 7 days a week because our demand goes up and up and up. This year, we're for the start of the year, 59% up on referrals to last year. That's how much people are struggling. And obviously you have to staff that so that you don't have ever end up with a waiting list, because our heartbeat is we don't have a waiting list. That's the whole point. So we staff it and go, oh, how are we going to pay for that? Well, we're going to have to work it out after, because those people need to be seen immediately. So yeah, it's people are really, really struggling at the moment.
I imagine it's not going to get any better over the next couple of years. If anything, the demand is going to get higher and higher.
Our demand's never gone down.
No.
Since we started. So in our first year, we delivered 400 interventions. And I don't know how we did that, to be honest, because it was me and some volunteers and this building that, like, we just kind of, the community had come out in force and painted it and stuff, and we had nothing. And we did 400, and we were like, that's amazing. If we can do that every year, you know, we've made a real difference here. We do nearly 400 a week now. We're 6.5 years in. We do nearly 400 a week. I think last week we did 366 suicide interventions. That's huge.
Yes.
Like, that's a lot of struggling people.
Yeah. How many staff do you actually employ at the moment? I'm just thinking that this isn't a 9-to-5 kind of job, is it? This is something that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. How do you even recruit staff for something like this?
You've got to live and breathe it. You've got to be really passionate about it. We're open 9:30 till 4:30, 7 days a week. We've got 26 members of staff across the four bases that we've got now. And they all just work so hard. So people say, how do you keep up with that increased demand? How do you never have a waiting list? Because the staff work so hard, because they truly care. Mm. So the majority of them have been through it themselves.
Yeah.
They've lost some of themselves, or they've been in that position themselves. And it's lit a fire in their belly that has made them go, yeah, I finish at 4:30, but if there's somebody sat there waiting that's in crisis, I'm not walking out of here at 4:30, because that's really important. That person can't wait. And if that was my loved one that I've lost, I would want them to be treated in this way. They're just amazing, amazing people.
I know three people who've lost someone directly close to them, partner, child, to suicide. Now four, now I know you. And every person left behind will tell you the same thing.
Yeah.
That in hindsight, or if only this service would have answered the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a moment at 1 o'clock in the morning when I needed help and I couldn't get help to help them. Do you provide that out of hours service? Because that's definitely something I hear time and time again.
Yeah, I wish we did. But we can barely afford to keep our doors open at 9:30 till 4:30. Mm-hmm. But what we do when we build those safety plans with people is we build in extra safety nets. So like, okay, out of hours, here's your helplines. Here's the different people you can call. If you can't keep yourself safe, here's A&A. Here's your crisis line.
Okay.
So when you finish building safety nets in, build another one in, you know, just for good measure.
Yeah.
Belt and braces and all of that. I wish we could be open 24 hours a day. And I wish we could be open up and down the country.
Yeah.
But the reality for small charities right now is we're taking on a lot of work that is a statutory provision, really, and nobody's given us the money to do it. So we've got amazing grant funders.
Mm-hmm.
We've got amazing people that give us money. We've got our NHS subcontract. But if your demand is going up that much, as is the cost of running an organisation with NI and stuff like that, then how do you meet that? And it's a difficult time for charities at the minute, because people haven't got as much money in their pocket to give as they used to.
Yeah.
So we've still got amazing people running marathons, climbing mountains, doing all sorts of stuff for us. But what people give to them to do that is less than it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Of course, yeah.
So if you put that together with the increased demand and the fact that we refuse to ever have a waiting list, you end up with a deficit of money there, don't you?
Yes.
And it ends up with me and my colleague Darren kind of sitting up at night, all through the night, going, right, what can we do here? Who can we ask for money? What can we do? And the reality is the charity sector shouldn't really be operating like that.
No.
But that's what it is. That's kind of what we signed up for. That's the name of the game.
There's a couple of things left for us to talk about. One of them being the amazing things that you have achieved in the time that you've been doing this. So talk us through it. The first time you thought, I'm making waves.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing something so important, but it's actually working.
Yeah. Oh gosh, that's really difficult. So I've always believed that everything happens for a reason. Mm. I'm not a religious person, but I do believe that everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
And when my dad died, that really shook my faith in that, because why on earth has this horrible thing happened to us? We're good people. We're a good family. You know, why has this happened to us? And I think it was about 2 years in to the MGP journey that I had this little light bulb moment where I went, okay, that's the reason. That's why that happened. Because I think we ran our figures at the end of the year and the amount of people we'd supported, I was like, okay, those are the reasons.
Yeah.
I think we're on like 49,500 interventions at the minute over the 6.5 years. So for me now, there's 49,500 reasons why it happened, you know?
Yeah.
And I do find that helpful as somebody that's bereaved by suicide to see those families that come in and say, people stop you in the street when you've got one of the hoodies on and they say, you saved my dad's life, you saved my mum's life, you saved my daughter's life. So there's parents out there that still have their children because of what the team do.
That's incredible.
When it all becomes worthwhile.
Yeah. And it doesn't just stop with, oh, we've stopped it this time, so that's the end of that. It's knowing that if this resurfaces again, if the signs start showing again, which sadly we do see that with people, you know, we've experienced it personally, and people listening will be like, it's not a one-off thing where you're just cured, you know, that's great.
Magic wand.
Yeah, it just goes right through life then, doesn't it? But to know that you've had success and you've saved someone's life in that moment as a family member, knowing you've done it with your support and that they can come back to you, the thought of what you do disappearing then must be terrifying. So that's why this funding's so important, isn't it?
It's so important. And we wrap this bubble around the family. So we don't just support the person that's considering suicide. They come and they see our suicide intervention workers and they work through that for as long as they need. They then go into our postvention support where they rebuild all those things that they've lost during that time.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, somebody else is supporting the family member and sitting with them and being a sounding board for them. And then training them and teaching them in what to do to create extra safety nets at home.
Yeah.
And then in the future, if anything happens again, because we don't have a waiting list, they know they can literally walk back in through the front door.
Yes.
And be seen immediately.
Yeah.
And
it's a face.
Yeah.
That's so hard in 2025 to ring a number, a helpline, or to even your GP. We can all relate to that. To get an appointment face to face with another human to talk about whether it's a sore back or it's a mole that looks a bit dodgy. To speak to someone directly face to face is really difficult.
I don't know about you, but I just want to go into the bank and speak to somebody. I just want to go into the bank and do my banking.
So if your doors are open and people can walk in and it's a face that they've spoken to before.
Yeah.
It's someone that's got them to the other side before. That must be the best feeling in the world.
And it's dead chill. It's non-clinical. So it feels a little bit like this. It feels like somebody's living room. The staff do not wear suits. Nobody wears a lanyard. It's not a them and us type situation. Yeah. It's somebody who truly gets it and truly cares sitting across from you at the worst time of your life and saying, tell me all about it.
Yeah.
Let's work through this together. And I think the fact that it's face-to-face is a real USP.
Yeah.
Because I think you do struggle to get face-to-face support.
Yeah.
And so many people want to be seen face-to-face. They say, this is really important.
It's necessary. Not only for the person who's considering suicide, for the family members that feel helpless.
Yeah.
It's so necessary. It's the only thing they need. They need to speak to a human, look someone in the eyes.
Yeah.
You can't be on the end of the phone with that weight on your shoulder. You can't. If you could wave a magic wand across the country now, and they give you an unlimited pot of money, what do people really need that would put you out of
a
job? You know, so, that would stop you doing what you'd be unneeded. You'd be surplus to requirements.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Wouldn't that be the dream? What, with your magic wand, what have you seen firsthand that's missing?
Oh gosh, that's such a loaded question, isn't it? At the moment, the biggest thing we're seeing is money, cost of living crisis.
Yeah.
So we went through COVID. Our demand went up and up and up during COVID. We stayed open during COVID. Sent a little tweet to Boris and said, can we stay open during COVID? This is what we are. If I don't hear back from you by such and such a date, I'll take it as an agreement that we can. And obviously he never came back to me because he was dead busy. So we stayed open.
Yes.
So stayed open, saw record numbers through COVID. Then we thought, right, it might calm down a little bit now at the end of this. And it didn't, because then cost of living crisis hit. So it got worse and worse and worse. The biggest thing we see is finances. And then just the world is difficult at the minute, isn't it? There's so much that I don't think we will ever fix. Kind of people go through hard times. I don't think we'll ever be able to fix that. But what we can give them is timely, compassionate support at the time that they need it within their own communities with people that they trust.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a one size fits all. If it was a one thing, if it was, say, just finances, we'd be saying, okay, let's fix everybody's finances and suicide won't exist. But because suicide is so complex and so many different things feed into people having thoughts of suicide, you'd have to fix everything in the world, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So one of the things that comes across quite clearly talking to you is that you feel you were lacking in that support where someone could give you the tools to help you deal. You wasn't asking someone to come and fix your dad. Yeah. You wasn't asking someone to take the weight from you. You just wanted that help to support you, mm-hmm. to support him.
Yes.
And since you lost your dad and all the years that passed, have you seen a change? Are people reporting a change? Is there more help out there, you know, as standard than there was?
People are more open to talking about it now. A lot of work has gone on in the suicide prevention world to get people comfortable talking about it, which is, you know, a really big step forward.
But as in services that aren't charities, services that we should have access to. Mm-hmm.
Well, demand's just gone up and up, hasn't it? So it's gone up for all of those kind of statutory services as well. Yeah. Everybody is just kind of like swimming uphill. Every service that I know, including the NHS, we're all just swimming uphill.
But you're not hearing of any progression, or people aren't coming to you and saying, well, this is available now that wasn't available to you. Are you seeing any progress there? Or do you feel like it's never been more important for you to be doing what you're doing?
I think that there's been a lot of progress and people have worked so, so hard in this sector over a number of years, but you can't get there quick enough to keep up with the increased demand.
Yeah.
So, you know, the charity sector is moving at a mile a minute. We're like swans with our little legs under the horse, you know, but then people are struggling more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
That to keep up with that is just so hard. However, I've seen a massive change in the stigma that surrounds suicide.
Yeah.
I remember when we opened our first building, people said to me, you can't write suicide on that signage. And I said, well, why not? And they said, oh, you know, you can't write suicide above on a shop front. And I said, but why not? That's our slogan, preventing suicide, breaking down stigma, supporting families. And what they wanted was it to be some secret little side door when people went in a shameful way because it was a dirty word and went and asked for help. And I was like, absolutely not.
No.
This is part of breaking that stigma. We're owning it. There's nothing to be ashamed of. We put it right on the middle of a high street in New Ferry. So it's the same as kind of, it should be as normal as walking into a coffee shop to buy a coffee or walking into the hairdressers and asking for a trim, walking into a suicide place and asking for some help, because actually so many of us are going through it. 1 in 5 of us are having thoughts of suicide at any one time.
Yeah.
So why would we not put that in the heart of our communities where people feel safe?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's common sense to me, I think.
What you're doing is just, it's obviously so important. Okay. And I think you're answering my question in your own way without saying what I feel.
Sorry,
we're all thinking.
I think
that the thought behind it is I look at Zoe's Place and the countless, I could list charities in Liverpool alone doing the things that need to be done to the best of their ability, but relying on charity funding.
Yeah.
So what I'm asking is these people who are coming to you because they're not getting it from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, money's not growing on trees and the government are doing whatever they feel fit at the moment to do. But there's this massive gap in this service that should be available to everybody without going to a charity.
Yeah.
And I was sort of hoping you were going to say, yeah, people are coming through the doors and they are reporting that difference to when you were dealing with it with your dad.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if there is any money going to these services. And I think from what you're saying, we're smiling at each other and I think you're being lovely about it, but I'm going to say it for you. Without these charities, there's a massive gap.
Yeah, there's a huge gap. And I think that's the charity sector as a whole, right? So if you were to pull these charities overnight, the country would fall down.
Yeah. And it sounds like to me, and we all agree on this one, I'll use Zoe's Place again as an example, for the community to be funding a place where our babies are going for their final moments, and that not being government funded and not being something that we should be able to just lean upon when our families are in crisis. The same with what you're doing right now. It's such a shame. But then I look at you and I say, thank God for you.
Oh, thanks.
Thank God for you when you could have, in your time of need, crumbled, disappeared, never wanted to deal with it ever again. And I hope you go through the rest of your life and nobody ever comes near you with mental health problems who need your support because, you know, you've been through it. And it must have been so traumatic, every stage of that throughout your childhood and into womanhood. And then you had your own baby and this happened. And I just think, thank God that you did find the strength from somewhere. And so many people like you do the same, whether it's people who work for you or setting up their own charities for whatever reason to fill those gaps. So the rest of us have got somewhere to go if ever it's needed.
Yeah, I it's not right that the charity sector is the way that it is, but that's the way that it is.
And it's where we are.
And I don't know where the strength came from. I really don't know where the strength came from. And I was in a horrible, abusive relationship at the time. And I'd been too scared to leave for a really long time because I always thought when I left that he would kill me. So, but something happened when my dad died where I was like, I'm not spending another minute living a life that's not good enough for me. I've seen how short life is. So I did leave and I quit my job and set up the charity. And if you ask me to go back and replicate that now, I don't think I could because there was something in me, like anger, guilt, passion. There was this fire in my belly that failing in setting up what I wanted to set up just wasn't an option. And people were saying, well, what's the backup plan? What if it doesn't work, Jess? And I'm like, well, it will work.
Yes.
And I used to kind of, I was on my own with Leo then. I'd drop him at nursery in the morning. I was the first person at the nursery, you know. Mm-hmm. I'd go and open the building. I wasn't taking a salary at all at the time. My first salary out of MGP was £100 a month and I was working every hour God sent. And that was after 18 months. So I'd drop Leo at nursery. I'd go, I'd deliver suicide interventions all day because it was just me and these volunteers, right?
You have to go and then through it yourself.
And I was still broken.
Where you got that strength.
I don't know where it came. I really don't know where it came from because I was still broken myself. And then I'd pick him up, I'd close the service, I'd pick Leo up at like 6 o'clock, I'd take him home, I'd spend an hour with him, feed him, put him to bed, and then 7 o'clock would come and I'd open my laptop and start writing funding bids till 2 o'clock in the morning to secure the money to carry on and to build it and grow it and to get some staff to do it. And then I'd get up the next morning and go again.
Yeah.
And you can only do something like that when you have been to the absolute depths of hell.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it came from. If you asked me to just do it now, what, now I'm all kind of healed and fixed, I wouldn't be able to.
No.
It was that grief. But I think it kept me alive too.
Yeah.
I think it kept me safe at times where I probably would have given up. Mm-hmm. I wanted nothing more than to give up after my dad died. I desperately wanted to be with him. And I suppose what kept me alive was knowing that I had little Leo and that I was in this abusive relationship. And if I were to leave this planet, little Leo would be left with that abuser, with that person. And that kept me going. And then starting the service, that kept me going. And before you knew it, I was like, oh, hang on a minute. I actually want to be alive now. I'm not doing this because I'm running the service or because Leo would be left in a dangerous situation because that's all sorted. I'm doing this because I actually want to live now. So I suppose I just know firsthand that kind of value of staying safe for now until we can figure things out, because there's always another way.
Yeah.
There's always another option. And, you know, just sticking out, just one more day. And I promise you, you'll start having these days where you wake up and you think, hang on a minute, I'm alive today because I want to be alive today, not because of X, Y, Z. And I just know that that can work for other people too.
It's just wonderful to hear you speak.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to know that this is what this podcast is about. Yes, we have so many different episodes and so many different stories, but for the people who need to hear this, hearing this today, I'm proud of you. So proud of you. And just finally, for those people who are now sitting there thinking, I know who I need to speak to. Mm-hmm. I know where I need to go. This is my lifeline. I've listened to this for a reason. Or they want to pass it on to someone who they know needs you and what you do. Mm-hmm. Please give us the details again.
Okay. So I guess there will be people listening right now that'll go, I think there is something going on with my friend, and having listened to that, I'm going to go and ask them a question. And that's really important because that's how we create suicide safer communities. I suppose you could send them the link to this podcast for them to listen themselves and give them a gentle nudge in that direction and then open up a conversation. You can refer in on the website. So we're a Northwest charity. Yeah. So we cover the Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
However, we'd never turn anybody away. Yeah. But you didn't hear that from me. So we've got bases on the Wirral, Chester, Macclesfield and Crewe. So you refer in on the website. It's you don't have to download anything and print anything out. It's dead easy. You go in, you fill in the details and you can refer a loved one as long as you've got their consent. So they do have to agree to it. So they refer it on the website and then they're contacted within 24 hours, usually loads quicker, but we say 24 hours. So you do need to check that they can stay safe for that 24 hours.
What's that website for us, Jeff?
So the website is themartingalliaproject.org, and I'll spell it for you because it's the story of my life, spelling my surname.
Okay, get your mobiles out, everyone. If you listen on Spotify, swipe up, you'll still be able to hear us. It's fine. Go into your notes, the little yellow orangey square, tap that and then type this out, or go old school, pen and paper.
So www.themartin and then Gallia is G-A-L-L-I-E-R project.org. So normal spelling of Martin, Gallia is G-A-L-L-I-E-R project.org. I've been doing that since I was a little girl.
Do you know, once you've found that website, copy it and then put it on an Instagram story, share. Share, 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 because you don't know who amongst your circle might need it. So spread the word for our Jess. Make sure you share that link on all your social media pages. Jump on your Facebook. Spread the word. Share this podcast, because you just don't know who needs to be listening. Jess, thank you so much. Such an important episode. It's been a joy to have you. And lovely Leo, who's been good as gold in the corner.
He's been doing this since he was little.
He's a diamond. Anything else we can do for you here at Lady Liverpool, don't be afraid to ask.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Subscribe now
via the iTunes Store.
Hear more from the Ladies of Liverpool
via ladiesofliverpool.com.
Huge thanks to our sponsors, Taskers. Check out all the furniture and their brand new look in store, or head to taskersonline.com.